Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Our Madonna Week continues as we mark the 30th anniversary of Madonna's debut self-titled album. And in addition to the thoughts and reminiscences of our guests here in the studio, our phone line has been buzzing with your Madonna moments. Here's Tracy from Queens.
Madonna started the whole craze of wearing those black bracelets. They were just basically like a thin piece of rubber, but she would wear them, and so everyone started wearing them. And the first time and only time I ever shoplifted an item was a package of those bracelets at a flea market, and I was caught. And well, that moment stays with me forever. I just wanted to look like all of my friends. Thanks, Madonna.
Bitter thank you from Tracy, who is apparently still repaying her debt to society, probably in some correctional facility there in Queens. Let's see if we can get a more uplifting Madonna memory from Dar here in New York. Dar tells us that he was working at a restaurant in Virginia Beach one summer.
And every day, the male singer in the band would sing Like a Virgin. And then, so I really started to hate that song, but I actually liked Madonna a lot. And the next summer, I had a job working for a bank. I had two bosses, and they were both, to say it nicely, obese, young ladies in their probably late 20s or early 30s. And I remember I had been traveling around the state going from bank to bank, and they invited me out to dinner when I got back with a big group of people, and I was all excited to go out to dinner. And then everybody was out on the dance floor, and Like a Virgin came on, of course, a song I wasn't very fond of at that point. But both of these quite obese ladies with their 19 or 20-year-old charge decided that they were going to dance when what modern terms would be called twerking with me, one from behind and one from in front. So that's my Like a Virgin moment. I guess they thought the song was about me.
Brave, brave Dar from New York. Sharing your trauma with the rest of us, Dar, can only help you work through the pain. Okay, one more dip into the old voicemail. Let's hope for a happy Madonna moment from Susie in the Bronx.
I was at Danceteria years ago when Madonna appeared there. I didn't even want to look in to see her, but my boyfriend went to the floor where she was playing, and he said there was around 20 people standing around listlessly. I eventually became a fan, bought her albums, loved Erotica, bought a sex book for my boyfriend. She used to be great, but now she sucks. So my advice to Madonna is hang up your bra, your toast.
You people are killing me. You're killing me here. We're supposed to be celebrating Madonna. Celebrating. Go back to last night's show when Weird Al Yankovic talked about Madonna asking him to turn her hit song Like a Virgin into Like a Surgeon. Actually, Weird Al is back on the show today. He has a new children's book that we'll hear about. Also, sax player and best-selling novelist James McBride is on a book tour with his band. You'll hear why, and we'll talk about his hilarious new novel, The Good Lord Bird, later on the show. But first, back to the material girl. No sooner did Madonna conquer the pop charts than she embarked on another career, as an actor. It started with Desperately Seeking Susan, which featured this Madonna hit, and moved up and down through films like A League of Their Own, Evita, Dick Tracy, and over a dozen more. She's even directed several movies herself. Joining me to look at Madonna's film career are Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, the co-hosts of the Takeaways Movie Date Podcast. Good to have you guys back on Soundcheck.
Nice to be
Hi,
here.
John.
So let me just put this out there, that Madonna as an actress has not garnered nearly the acclaim as Madonna the musician.
That is absolutely true. Although, I mean, she has received many Razzie nominations, and
the Razzies are for like the bad movies, the bad action. And she holds the record for most Razzie nominations and wins.
So that's something. That's something.
So her acting has received a lot of attention. Yes.
So what's wrong? I mean, she's such a charismatic performer. Why wouldn't that naturally translate onto celluloid?
You know, I think a lot of musicians think that it will because they are such performers on stage. And, you know, and so many people have tried this, right? Bowie, Jagger, I mean, the list.
Sinatra.
You know, Sinatra. Sinatra, I think, actually did pretty well,
yes,
though, right?
Yes, he did.
Manchurian Candidate. I don't know why Madonna isn't able to translate. I guess it's because she's such a compendium of personas, and maybe she can't sort of inhabit the role that's written into a script for her. I don't know why it is.
I think it's because she can't be realistic. I think that she is such a performer, and she's so much a big show, and that's what makes her a great stage act, a great concert to see. And when she tried Broadway, people said she was fantastic there, but the subtleties of the camera, dealing with close-ups, dealing with interacting with others as opposed to just being the center of attention, I think that's a big challenge for Madonna.
Are you saying there's no there? there's no central core to pull on when it comes to the...
I'm saying there's a big difference between showmanship and great acting.
All right. In 1986, Madonna co-starred in a movie called Shanghai Surprise with her then-husband Sean Penn. She picked up a Razzie for it and got some pretty bad reviews.
You know, I could have stayed home in Brooklyn, Massachusetts and married a nice Ivy League banker.
Why didn't you?
Well, for the whole country standing in a bread line and I just wanted to do something useful. Where could I wind up with a bunch of chickens?
Then ducks.
That is some of the worst fake crying I have... I mean...
And ducks.
All right. So you guys are here to perhaps show us, you know, another side of Madonna's acting career. We've asked each of you to pick a film. We've also asked our listeners via Twitter, what do you think about Madonna as an actress? And folks, you can still tweet us at Soundcheck or leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. Let me read you guys what James tweeted at us. Her best, Desperately Seeking Susan, Dick Tracy, League of Their Own, Evita. Her worst, Swept Away, Shanghai Surprise. Always felt Madonna did not get enough credit for Evita, which was a real acting challenge and a high-impact vocal workout. Now, Kristen, Evita's your choice, right?
Evita is my choice, and I think one of the reasons why is... that's a great tweet, by the way, but I think that one of the reasons why is what I was saying earlier about the showmanship and about almost every song that she sings, it's not a duet. It's really her by herself. It's her being the center of attention. But also something that Evita does, which is similar to Desperately Seeking Susan, is she's playing kind of a fantasy version of how the public already perceives her to be. This is somebody who lost a parent, worked her way to the top, used her sexuality as a centerpiece, possibly manipulated people, and just then ended up all up there on stage as the center of attention. And that's the Evita story, and that's really how at least her public persona is.
Rafer, didn't this movie get, like, mixed reviews at best?
I think people actually were quite impressed with Madonna. I mean, I remember this was one of the times when people thought, oh, you know, maybe there's something more to her. Maybe she actually can act.
So people liked her maybe more than the film, which I, you know, I've read reviews where it's just like, oh, it's much ado about it. It's too much, you know.
Yeah, Alan Parker, I think, was the director,
right,
who can be a very over the top director. I remember Angel Heart, I love that movie. I'm one of the few people who does, but yeah, he's a very over the top director. But, you know, again, I mean, this is a perfect role for Madonna, but also all she has to do is basically sing her way through it. It's kind of like, it's sort of acting the way an opera singer would act. It's not still quite movie acting, you know?
Now, the film Evita is an adaptation, of course, of the musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. And I guess, Kristen, when people think of the musical Evita, most of us think of one song.
Oh, yes. Don't Cry for Me. We all know it.
So what do you think of her performance of this song in the film?
it's really a shame because we think of Madonna mostly as a singer, and she's in this movie that's a musical and it's all about singing. But the one centerpiece song, the one song we all think about with Evita, she just doesn't quite deliver. And you see, unfortunately, her limitations as a singer in the song.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. The truth is I never left you. All through my wild days, my mad existence, I kept my promise. Don't keep your distance. Have I said too much? There's nothing more I can think of to say to you. But all you have to do is look at me to know that every word is true.
Don't cry for me, Argentina. That is the hit tune from the musical Evita, when it was on Broadway and in London's West End, with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber and lyrics by Tim Rice. Then when they made the film, not the high point of the movie, is, I gather, what you're saying, Kristen.
Unfortunately not. No, I really think this song should be belted out. This is a song where she's on a balcony. There are tens of thousands of people in the streets who are looking up to her and seeing her as almost an angel, as a sex symbol, as a lot of things. And I'm not going to imitate her singing here. We just heard it, but it sounds a little flat. It doesn't sound like it's being belted out.
But you don't mean flat as in pitch, just flat as in emotional effect.
Sounds
exactly.
Thin.
Thin is the right word. Yeah, thin is the right word, Rafer.
Her voice would deepen and get better, actually, over the next like 5 or 6 years as she got a little older, I think.
Yeah.
So it's Madonna week on Soundcheck, and for the next few days, we're looking back at her 30-year career. It was 30 years ago this summer that she released that first album, and listeners, we want to hear from you. Tell us about a moment in your life that was marked by Madonna and her music or her films in some way. Call us up with your Madonna moment at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612, or find our contact info at soundcheck.org. Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman are the co-hosts of the Takeaways Movie Date podcast, and at the moment, we're talking about Kristen's pick, which is Evita, despite Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. Now, most of the singing, that song included, was lip-synced for the film, right?
Yeah, she taped it in advance, and the movie is very much like a music video. It's filled with montages, and much like a music video, there's so much spectacle, but it's all lip-synced pre-recorded songs.
Is that... Could that, Rafer, be part of the problem with, you know, you were talking about Alan Parker, the director, and the over-the-topness of some of his work? Was it like a video that had just, on steroids, that was just like 2 hours long instead of seven minutes?
Or? I have to say, I'm a fan of, after Les Miserables, I'm a fan of the lip-synced musical movie.
Uh-huh.
I think that's really what ruined Les Miserables, was everyone sang live. Everyone had really good voices, but I think you know, visually that meant that the camera had to stay on their faces and just do a close-up the whole time. I think when you lip-sync, it gives you a lot more freedom.
Well, now, there is one moment in the film that is not lip-synced.
Just one, and that's a very important scene. I don't want to be a spoiler here, but I think everyone knows the story. Ava Perone, she's dying in the end. I'm just going to say it, folks.
Yeah.
She's dying, and she's singing a song, and the song is not lip-synced.
And how is this for emotional effect as opposed to the lip-synced parts?
It's somewhat closer to acting.
and just to make it clear, you like this film, right?
I do. And you know what? I don't think I love it as an acting tour de force. I like it for the same reason I like Madonna's music videos. I like it for the same reason I like Madonna on stage. I like it for the same reason that Madonna's a fantastic spectacle and a great performer. I don't like it because I think she's the next Meryl Streep.
All right. Here's Madonna in the role of Eva Perón in the deathbed scene, singing live on screen during the film Evita.
The choice was mine, and mine completely. I could have any prize that I desired. I could burn with the splendor
of the brightest fire, or else I could choose time.
A little bit of the deathbed scene. So that's Madonna. That's as naked. I mean, we've seen her almost naked, you know, on her videos and stuff. But, I mean, the voice is really naked there.
Yeah, and remember that real Eva Perón at this point in her life, she's 79 pounds. She has cancer. She's only 33 years old.
Yeah.
She's a young woman who's reaching her end. And I think Madonna actually is sort of acting in that scene.
Yeah. Rafer, what do you think of Evita as a film?
I mean, I remember it being kind of in some ways, a typical musical of its time. A lot of, you know, a lot of sets, a lot of costumes. The lighting was very exaggerated. It almost in some ways was a kind of a companion piece to Dick Tracy. It a little on the cartoonish side, mm-hmm. you know.
Another movie that she was in.
Yes. Although Evita, much better, clearly.
Okay. One thing, now that you mentioned the costume changes, I do recall reading numerous reviewers mentioning the fact that she wore like 80, 85 different costumes in the course of a single movie.
She wore a lot of costumes in this, and she's supposed to wear a lot of costumes. She's Eva Perón.
Yeah.
She likes her shopping. She likes her furs. She likes her dresses. She's going from poor girl to rich girl. And notably, she was pregnant through most of this movie, so they had to do costume changes to cover that up, too, throughout it.
The music, of course, adapted from the hit musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice. And since the music pre-existed the film, they were not eligible for an Oscar. Unless
they have a best original song that they write just for the movie, which they did do.
That old trick.
Oh, that old trick. We've seen that one before.
Just like Les Miserables.
Yes.
So they wrote this additional song called You Must Love Me, and this ended up winning the Academy Award for Best Original Song.
Why are you at my side? How can I be any use to you now? Give me a chance and I'll let you see how nothing has changed. Deep in my heart, I'm concealing things that I'm longing to say. Scared to confess what I'm feeling. Frightened you'll slip away. You must love me.
That is Madonna and the song You Must Love Me, which won an Oscar for Best Original Song from the movie Evita, because that is the song that they wrote specifically for the film, for the sole purpose of being nominated and hopefully winning that award. They being Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, but of course that's Madonna, whose film career is the subject of our discussion right now with Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer, the co-hosts of the Takeaways Movie Date podcast. So Evita is Kristen's pick. Rafer, what's yours?
My pick is Truth or Dare, the documentary, quote-unquote, from 1991.
Why quote-unquote?
Well, I think when this movie came out, it was a real cause for concern among reviewers about whether or not this was the real unvarnished truth. You know, was this the real Madonna? I think this film, though, was kind of the death knell for the modern rock doc. I think it put an end to this idea that you'd have a D.A. Pennebaker or a Maisel's Brothers coming in for Dylan or the Stones. This was Madonna calling the shots. You know, she handpicked the director, you know, produced mm-hmm. the film, mm-hmm. narrated it. And I think people had a lot of problems with that at the time.
Did you guys have problems with it?
No, I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic version of a concert movie unlike anything I'd ever seen before. It was so spectacular. It was all in black and white when it was just her being, quote, real, and in full spectacular color when she was on tour. And
on stage.
Yeah, on stage. It was just fantastic to look at, and it really just, it moves at the tempo of a music video, and it's so fun to watch.
Is she acting?
I mean, it's a great question, right? I mean, she is. You see her behind the backstage, mm-hmm. you know, in her hotel room, you know, on the bus, all these places, interacting with her dancers, her makeup artist, all these people that are in millions of people in her entourage. You don't really get the feeling, though, that she's ever letting down her guard. And of course, my favorite scene in that movie is with two of my favorite scenes involve Warren Beatty. One is who she was dating at the time. One is when he just sort of walks around refusing to talk to her or speak or say anything on record. And one is when he finally kind of lets loose on her and criticizes her for this whole shtick that she's doing.
This is crazy. Nobody talks about this on film?
Talks about what?
The insanity of doing this fall on a documentary. Well, this is a serious matter, your throat, yes?
Why should I stop here?
But does anyone say it?
Who's anyone?
Well, anyone that comes into this insane atmosphere. You realize they all feel it when they come into this atmosphere. When they come into your dressing room, when they come wherever you are, they feel crazy. Now, do they talk about it?
No, they accept it.
Why don't they talk about it?
Because.
Well, you want to think about that, don't you?
No, I don't. So let's get back to my throat.
Do you want to talk at all off camera? You have nothing to say.
She doesn't want to live off camera, much less
talk. I think that's what it is.
There's nothing to say off camera. Why would you say something if it's off camera?
And tomorrow, you're going
What point is there of existing?
So if it doesn't happen on camera, Madonna, it's like it doesn't have. That's basically what Warren Beatty is saying.
It's incredibly hostile, but also fairly insightful moment from Warren Beatty.
Just to say, I mean, she's just come from the doctor.
She's actually at the doctor, and she's just had some sort of strange towel wrapped around her tongue, and the doctor's been poking around her throat. She's got a voice problem. They're actually at the doctor, and that's the doctor who says, you know, who wants to ask her, is there anything you know you want to say on camera? And Warren Beatty just lets loose on her. But it's true. And, you know, you can hear him say that this idea of being on camera in a documentary, letting the cameras in, is an insane idea, which is a funny thing to hear a celebrity say in 2013.
An actor.
Yeah. An actor. I mean, I think that was a weird idea in 1991. But, I mean, you know, fast forward to today, and that's all anyone ever does. That's the reason people are famous, is because they put themselves on camera, you know?
But we were so naive back then, Rafer. We didn't understand reality versus script versus – we were so naive.
We didn't know what reality with a capital R meant.
Yes, exactly.
There just wasn't enough housewife-based programming to prepare us for that sort of thing yet. We're talking about the 1990 Blonde Ambition Tour.
That's right.
The focus of the film Truth or Dare. And the question that I asked before, is she acting? That's kind of – she goes there, like right away in the opening of the film.
Well, she does give this kind of monologue, and
right.
And it's funny because I think when I first saw the film, it seemed real enough to me, and now when I went back and saw it, I thought, this is exactly the kind of monologue you see everyone in every reality show do. They always cut away from the action, sit that person down and say, okay, spill your guts in this particular way.
Right.
And that's what everyone does. Oh, I feel this. Everyone processes for about 5 minutes on camera, and she's doing that. Again, you know, for better or for worse, this film was light years ahead of its time, you know?
This is from the opening of the film Truth or Dare, Madonna's opening monologue.
You know, I think I'm in a state of shock. I know the tour's over, but it's like last week in Spain. I really felt like I was going to have a nervous breakdown. I couldn't take the crowds outside. I couldn't do the shows. It was too hot. Everything was getting to me, and I thought, I think I'm getting ready for the depression of what I'm going to feel when the tour's over with, but I really didn't feel emotional last night. I know everybody else did and everyone was crying, but I didn't feel emotional. It was like it already ended for me. It's like when you know someone's dying, you have to make your peace kind of before they die. I've done this with close friends of mine. It's like I make my peace with it before it happens so I don't get really hurt. And then when it happens, it's like, I don't feel anything.
Wow.
Wow, that's so emotional.
Well, is it emotional or is she still on?
Right. I mean, that's the question. That's the question I think everybody wanted to know was how much of this, how much of these scenes were handpicked? And, you know, what didn't we get to see? You know, the one of the very first things you see in this movie is Madonna putting her hand to the camera, shoving the guy out of the hotel room and slamming the door, say, go away, I'm in a meeting. And it's almost like a wink to the audience. Yeah. It's almost like a wink to say, like, you know, and I know that I'm calling the shots here, and everything that's in this movie, I decided is going to be in this movie.
So are you saying that Truth or Dare is basically a big, long episode of The Office?
Yeah. You know what it is? It's one big, long Madonna commercial, and but this also goes back to the Beatles. It's like a version of the Beatles fan club recordings, only it's much longer and made available for everyone.
We've been talking about Madonna's film career, a little more checkered than her music career, which has certainly been something worth talking about and listening to for 30 years now. Again, our Madonna week, occasioned by the 30-year anniversary of her first record. I just want to mention her first movie, Desperately Seeking Susan. You know, this goes back, Kristen, to what you were saying before. That's Madonna.
That's what we imagine Madonna to be.
Yes,
and critics loved that movie. And most critics then also said, on the one hand, we love it. On the other hand, it's probably because we think she's playing herself. And it doesn't seem like much of a stretch. And that also goes back to both the movies that Rafer and I mentioned, that it's kind of a fantasy version of her. And I would say that that's a very fun movie. And some people might say it's the height of her acting career was that first movie.
I thought she was terrific in it, and you know, I thought that was the film that brought Get Into the Groove into our homes, and I was perfectly happy with that.
Yes, but before we go, I do have to point out, just to bring it back to Evita one last time, that she actually did win an award for Evita. I don't think she won any other acting awards in her life.
It was a Globe, I think.
It was
won,
a Golden
right?
Globe for best comedy/musical actress, and so. Even though we're kind of poking fun at Madonna and we're kind of pointing out that she's only best when she plays herself, she did actually win a legitimate acting award at one point.
All right. Kristen Meinzer and Rafer Guzman, the co-hosts of the Takeaways Movie Date podcast. Guys, thanks. Good to see you again.
Thanks so much, John, for having us.
Up next, we talk with the parodist who once turned Madonna's Like a Virgin into Like a Surgeon. It's Weird Al Yankovic telling us about his latest children's book and his own favorite authors growing up. This is Soundcheck.
You can have whatever you like.
You like.
I said you can have whatever you like.
You like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gator tots. Holds a gun.
Ice.
And we can clip coupons all night. And baby, you can have whatever you like. Whatever you like,
you like,
yeah. Take you out for dinner anywhere that you please. Like Burger King or Mickey D's, and baby, you can have whatever you like,
you like.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When you think of Weird Al Yankovic, you probably think of his vast canon of song parodies. He launched his career with send-ups of Michael Jackson hits in the 1980s, and in the background, you're hearing his more recent take on the song Whatever You Like by the rapper T.I. But the latest release from Weird Al is not another parody. It's a children's book called My New Teacher and Me.
Well, the truth can seem crazy, like that day in June when my grandfather famously walked on the moon. My grandfather even implied someday he might take me along for the ride. The class started cheering, "Take us! Take us too!" Then Mr. Booth bristled and snapped, "That'll do!"
Weird Al joins me from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. Hey, Al, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much, John.
So this is not your first children's book. You wrote When I Grow Up, but it's the same character, right? Billy?
It is. It's a bit of a sequel, I suppose. I wasn't ready to let go of Billy. I really enjoyed him as a character in the first book. So these are his further adventures. This is a brand new school year for Billy, and he has a little bit of a run-in with his new teacher. They don't quite get along or see things the same way.
Now, in the online trailer to the book, you point out this is not autobiographical, but did you have a teacher named Mr. Booth?
I never did. I probably drew from a little bit of personal experiences. I did have a couple of teachers earlier in my life where we didn't quite get along, or you know, I had an eighth grade, I won't mention any names, I had an eighth grade electric shop teacher who was a bit harsh, nobody liked him too much, and he would stomp on people's creativity, and I probably drew a little bit from that.
So were you a bit of a handful in shop class?
No, I kind of towed the line. Billy, the character in my book, is more the kid I wish I could have been, because Billy knows how to speak up for himself, and he finds his voice. I was a bit more intimidated at that age.
Mm-hmm. So it's a clash of personalities. You've got this strict teacher, Mr. Booth. You've got the freewheeling, highly imaginative, and very verbal Billy, and he's telling some tall tales. Let's hear a little bit from the audiobook version of Al Yankovic's My New Teacher and Me.
I said, "Hi, nice to meet you, sir. Billy's the name. See, a funny thing happened before the bus came. I was digging to China out in my backyard, and I almost was there when I hit something hard. Well, I dug and I dug and I dug a bit more and discovered the skull of a real dinosaur. And I would have cleaned up, sir, but hey, I'm no fool. I just couldn't be late on the first day of school." For a second or two, Mr. Booth kind of froze. Then he walked up to me, and he looked down his nose.
"I don't tolerate nonsense. No, not one degree. And your story sounds highly unlikely to me."
"Why, of course it's unlikely," I said. "Oh, by far. The awesomest things in the world often are."
That's a little bit from the book My New Teacher and Me from Weird Al Yankovic, although, Al, on the cover, you're credited as just Al Yankovic, no Weird, although Weird Al is in the bio on the back of the book.
A lot of people think that's a departure, but that's sort of the way I've always done it. Whenever I'm in front of a microphone or in front of the camera, I bill myself as Weird Al. But whenever I'm writing or directing or producing or doing anything behind the camera, it's just Al.
Okay. Now, the story here is one of, you know, of imagination, of creativity being allowed to flower, allowed to grow. Is that basically, I mean, do kids need that? Don't they just sort of naturally gravitate towards that sort of creativity?
Well, they do. That's the nature and the essence of being a kid, really. But this book, in a way, is sort of a cautionary tale about having that kind of creativity beaten out of you.
Mm.
There are people in your life that will maybe tell you to grow up and to and they might stifle some of that childlike wonder. And this is a book that really celebrates imagination.
So who is this book for? Is it for that creative little kid or for the exhausted parent who is reading to him or her?
I like to think that it's for everybody. I mean, ostensibly it's for children 4 to 8 years old, but I would hope that it's a book that parents will enjoy reading to their children, and maybe the parents will take a lesson away from it as well.
There's a little bit of an echo of Dr. Seuss in the kind of rhyming schemes that you use, although in your case, does that come from songwriting or does that come from other things that you've read?
Well, it's all of the above. Certainly, I've been writing song lyrics for a few decades now, and I've got that in my wheelhouse. But I was and continue to be a huge Dr. Seuss fan. When I was a small child, I would check out every Dr. Seuss book from the local public library. I'd memorize them. I'd write them out word for word. I just loved his wordplay and his sense of whimsy. And Dr. Seuss and Shel Silverstein and several others were huge influences on this book.
Hmm. And what about your own daughter? Do you read to her? Or did you read to her when she was younger?
I did. She's 10 years old now. She's a little bit beyond the picture book stage.
Yeah.
But when I first started writing children's books, she was in the perfect demographic. That was one of the reasons why I thought, oh, this will be great. I'll write some children's books. I'll have something to read to my daughter at bedtime. But the process of writing and actually getting the book published takes quite some time. So by the time my first children's book came out, she was really old enough that she was reading it to me for my bedtime story.
We're speaking with Weird Al Yankovic. His new book is called My New Teacher and Me. So was the impetus for the first book, When I Grow Up, was it having your daughter?
That was part of it, but full disclosure, I mean, I've always had a large interest in children's literature. As I said, I was a big Dr. Seuss fan, and in the back of my mind, I always thought that it would be fun to take a stab at kids' lit, and given the opportunity, I jumped at it.
Well, recently we had on the show Sandra Boynton, who, of course, has done tons of board books for very young kids and has also done a number of board books with music. And was there ever a kind of the idea that, hey, maybe, you know, as long as this rhyming scheme is working so well, maybe I just set a little melody to it, a little beat, you know, make some songs?
Well, Sandra's an old friend. We've been close for many years now. I actually did a duet with Kate Winslet on one of her CDs a few years ago.
Oh.
And yeah, Sandra's wonderful, and I've been a fan of hers forever as well. And to answer your question, you know, I do sort of have the rhythm going through my head, obviously, when I'm writing the words for the children's book. Maybe not so much of a melody, but I could see maybe somewhere down the line, doing what Sandra does, and maybe doing a book and CD combination. But you know, that would be for the future, I think.
Right. So your last full length album was Alpocalypse. That was in 2011. Does this second book signal, you know, kind of a new direction? Are you, when you finally wind up the Alpocalypse tour next month, will you be taking time off to write a different sort of thing?
It's not a different sort of thing. I've got one more album left on my contract, and it's not going to be a dramatic departure. It's going to be the same kind of thing you've come to expect from me.
Oh dear!
Actually, the album the next album is half done. I've got all the original songs. By originals, I mean pastiches that aren't based strictly on somebody else's music.
Mm-hmm.
I will be starting to work on the parodies when inspiration strikes. But hopefully, the new album will be out sometime in the next 30 to 40 years. We haven't narrowed it down yet.
You know, one of the things about children's books is no matter what happens with social media, the internet, technology, kids always need books read to them. Whereas, you know, your day job as a song parodist has changed utterly because of the internet.
That's true. I mean, what I do hasn't necessarily changed that much, but my place in the zeitgeist has. I mean, I used to have the song parody field pretty much to myself through most of the 80s and 90s, and now there are 20 billion people on YouTube doing funny songs and song parodies. So I'm still doing it, but I'm not unique anymore.
Yeah. The book is called My New Teacher and Me from Weird Al Yankovic, and Al will be appearing at three spots in the metropolitan area. September 25th, he'll be out on Long Island at the Barnes & Noble in Carle Place at 7 p.m., at the Barnes & Noble in Clifton, New Jersey on September 26th at 6 p.m., and you can catch him at the 92nd Street Y on Friday, September 27th at 8:15. When you do these, are these especially something like the 92nd Street Y, which has a great history of poets and writers coming and reading? Will that be what you're doing, or will it be more Q&A? Will there be any music involved? What are you doing these days?
I'm not performing. I'm doing an interview there with Dave Itzkoff from the New York Times, who's a wonderful and talented and very funny person. So that should be a lot of fun. I have no idea what he's going to ask me or what we're going to talk about, but it should be a good time.
All right. One last question, Al, before you go. What's on your nightstand? What are you reading these days?
Oh, what did I just finish? I just read a biography of Alan Sherman. I just read David Byrne's book, How Music Works.
That Alan Sherman book, Overweight Sensation, was kind of a fun read. We did a recent segment on Soundcheck about that. Listeners, you can find it on our archives at soundcheck.org. Weird Al Yankovic's new book is My New Teacher and Me. Al, it's been great fun talking to you again.
Thank you so much.
This is Soundcheck.
Once in a while, maybe you will feel the urge to break international copyright law by downloading MP3s from file sharing sites like Morpheus or Grokster or LimeWire or Kazaa. But deep in your heart, you know the guilt would drive you mad, and the shame would leave a permanent scar. 'Cause you start out stealing songs, then you're robbing liquor stores and selling crack and running over school kids with your car. So don't download this song.
Up next, we talk with author and musician James McBride, who wrote the best-selling book The Color of Water. He joins us to talk about his latest novel, the darkly funny Good Lord Bird. It's a fictionalized retelling of the story of 19th century abolitionist John Brown. Plus, he and a group of musicians play live music here in the studio. All of that next on Soundcheck.
John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. I've known for a long time that John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. Like some of you, I learned this old Civil War song, sung to the same melody as the battle hymn of the Republic, probably sometime back in grade school. But I didn't actually know a whole lot about who John Brown actually was until I read the new book by best-selling author James McBride called The Good Lord Bird. It's a fictionalized retelling of the anti-slavery rebel's story as seen through the eyes of a seriously misunderstood freed slave. Writer and musician James McBride joins me here in the Soundcheck studio with his band. James, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
So, John Brown, did you know that John Brown song growing up?
It was a church song, you know, it was something we sung in church, and So I knew that, and I knew faintly about him, but not much.
Yeah, I mean, I knew about the raid on Harper's Ferry, but not the sort of direct connection it had with, you know, helping to start the Civil War. Where did the inspiration for this book come from? Did it come from that song? From knowing?
No. I was monkeying around in Fredericksburg, Maryland, doing some research on a previous novel, and I saw John Brown's name mentioned, and I just decided to take a ride down to Harper's Ferry, and I was taken by what I saw. I was just fascinated by it, and I started to do some research on him, and I just thought it was a great story.
It's a pretty amazing story. This guy is possibly a lunatic. Certainly
overzealous.
Yeah. And he knows Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, making your book, Good Lord Bird, the second novel I've read this year in which Frederick Douglass is a character, because he's also in Colin McCann's Transatlantic.
Oh, cool. Well, good old Fred.
Yeah. It seems like John Brown did know these people.
Oh, yeah, he knew a lot of people. He knew Julia Ward Howe, and he knew all sorts of abolitionists. During this period, there were a lot of people who were alive. You know, Henry David Thoreau was around.
Right.
All these people knew who John Brown was. He was considered a very controversial figure. He was loved by the Northern abolitionists, and he was despised by the South. He was a white man who decided that slavery should end, and he was going to make a direct, directly try to end it himself.
Through force of arms,
Through force of arms and through arming blacks who he expected to join him in his raid on America's biggest arsenal.
And our narrator is probably around 12 years old when the action begins.
Right.
He's a boy named Henry. And for some reason, John Brown gets it into his head that Henry's a girl. And refuses to, you know, brook any kind of possibility that this could, in fact, be a boy. And the boy, Henry, just kind of goes with it.
Well, he plays with it. Yeah, I mean, John Brown kidnaps him or frees him when he goes into a tavern where Henry and his father are working.
Now, that's a little bit of a Freudian slip. You said kidnap first, because the distinction between freeing the slave and kidnapping this kid is a very fine one in this book.
I think the distinction between what freedom means and what freedom really was at that time was a lot more difficult to determine now, looking back, you know, 200 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So the kid was happy. He didn't know what freedom was. He was satisfied just shoving biscuits and ale down his throat. He was living in a tavern where everybody treated him nice, and they were all a bunch of hillbillies and rebels and so forth. But when John Brown sees him for the first time, he's dressed as a slave. In those days, slave children wore potato sacks, and they weren't. They just wore whatever people gave them. So John Brown just mistakenly assumes he's a girl.
Right.
And when the thing goes bad and people start shooting, Henry just decides to be quiet. And John Brown calls him Henrietta and ultimately calls him Onion.
Right.
And it's Onion who's telling us the whole story.
Right.
This book is really Onion's memoir.
And to go back to Frederick Douglass, it is a very funny book. And perhaps one of the funniest stories is Onion, who at this point is probably 13 or 14, doesn't know how old he is really,
right,
is drinking Frederick Douglass under the table because Frederick, also thinking that he is a she, is getting a little,
yeah, getting a little frisky.
Frisky.
Yeah, he wants a little bit of that, you know, equal rights, civil rights, you know, lubrication, you know. So, yeah, it's a very funny book. It's supposed to be funny. It's supposed to be readable and presenting slavery in a way that would allow people to sort of accept the reality of it, but yet also understand the historical context in which it takes place. And in a lot of ways, you can really get to the truth better than with fiction than you can with nonfiction.
Yeah. We're speaking with James McBride, the best-selling author of The Color of Water and the new book called The Good Lord Bird. I've never met an author who takes a band on the road for his book tour. But, I mean, you've been a sax player for many, many years.
Yeah, I've been playing music a long time. You know, I worked with
Jimmy Scott.
Worked with Little Jimmy Scott for a couple of years and worked with Anita Baker and Grover Washington. I wrote songs for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a musician when I wrote my first book, The Color of Water. I used to play down on Bleecker Street in New York and, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I did all that stuff. I mean, most musicians are pretty much writers. They just don't know structure and form, you know, and most musicians don't really have the patience or the desire or the know-how to sit down and write books. I mean, some do, and, mm-hmm. you know, some of them are pretty good books and some of them aren't. But I was a journalist for 9 years after I got out of school, and then I was a musician for 9 years. And while I was a musician, I wrote my first book, The Color of Water.
And so what do you refer to yourself as now?
A writerician. No, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know. I'm just, you know, I express myself with these two forms. They seem to work for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same. It's just storytelling.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter the form that you use, you know, if it's music or if it's literature. It's just a way of telling a story. And in this case, I thought it would be appropriate to go around with the band to do the kind of spiritual music that really inspired John Brown, because John Brown was very, very religious.
Right.
And I think people who are not religious, actually I'm fairly religious, I think people who are not religious do not understand the power that music has in terms of triggering and fostering and pushing religion into someone's soul, mm-hmm. and keeping it there.
We're speaking with James McBride, sax player and best-selling author of books like The Color of Water and Miracle at St. Anna. His latest novel is called The Good Lord Bird. It is a kind of fictionalized retelling of the tale of John Brown through the eyes of this cross-dressing young freed slave who goes by the name of Onion. And you're all here with instruments as well. So what's going to happen next?
Well, we're going to do a song that's a very old traditional song called Standing in the Need of Prayer. But since we have our instruments, we decided to do it in a little more conventional way, you know, because we are playing in front of audiences who don't want to hear just the traditional stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this features Keith Robinson on vocals, and it's an arrangement that we put together recently.
All right. Well, let's hear it.
All right.
James McBride is with us on Soundcheck with his band, and he will be speaking at the Brooklyn Book Festival this Sunday, the 22nd at 4 p.m., also speaking at a Harlem Jazz Museum event that they're doing at MIST Harlem, along with this band. That'll be next Tuesday, the 24th at 7 p.m. That is free as well. Here's a familiar old American song, Standing in the Need of Prayer, live on Soundcheck.
It's me, it's me, it's me all along, standing in the need of prayer. It's me. me. It's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's not my father, it's not my mother, but it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's not my sister, it's not my brother, but it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me, oh, it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. It's me, oh, it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. Oh, it's not the preacher, it's not the deacon, but it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of prayer. Oh, yeah. It's not the deacon, it's not the preacher, but it's me, oh Lord,
standing in the need of prayer.
Standing in the need of prayer. That is James McBride on sax, Keith Robinson on guitar and lead vocals, although everybody sang there as well. Showtime Brooks behind our drum kit, Trevor Exter playing the bass, Adam Falk at the piano. James McBride, as a musician yourself, can you listen to music while you're writing?
No, I never listen to music when I'm writing. In fact, when I'm writing a book, I very rarely listen to music at all, and nothing.
So when you're faced with the blank white page, though, how do you stop your mind from just, like, going off and listening to its own music?
Usually the mortgage bill that arrives at the end of the month helps you focus.
Ah.
But I usually, this book, The Good Lord Bird, was a kind of relief for me because I was going through a very painful divorce. So it was easy for me to just drop into this world and just have these adventures of the West. And I loved the wild. I loved Westerns.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was easy for me to vicariously live in this world and watch someone that I, you know, really loved and admired, John Brown, watch him do this stuff. So I didn't have any problem focusing here.
Will we be able to watch this? Has anybody optioned the book?
No, not yet. I mean, maybe they never will. But I didn't write it. I don't write books with the idea that, you know, I'm writing a film.
Right. It's just such a cinematic story, though, from the plains of Kansas heading east and going to Harper's Ferry, where the two rivers meet.
I think it's a great American story about a uniquely great American, whether you like him or not.
Mm. And one who had a pivotal role to play in the Civil War and, of course, what would come after that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, John Brown went to Europe to study how the European Napoleon and others fought their battles. He had really studied. He actually believed that he was going to be successful at Harper's Ferry.
Because he studied Garibaldi and Hannibal. And,
yeah. But then on the other hand, I studied Cannonball Adderley, and nobody's like, you know, my phone's not ringing.
James McBride is the best-selling author of the new book, The Good Lord Bird. It is a very funny book on top of everything else. And, James, it's been a real pleasure having you and the band here to celebrate with us today.
Well,
thanks very much.
We were delighted to come. It's a great show.
That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, we continue our Madonna Week with NPR Music's Ann Powers. She joins us for a deep dive into Madonna's 1998 album, Ray of Light. Plus, we hear about Madonna's connection to Detroit when we talk with a Detroit news writer who interviewed Madonna back in 1984, just a few years after Madonna left her hometown of Rochester, Michigan, and headed to New York. Plus, live music from the electro-hip-hop artist Dessa, live in our studio. Marco Benevento did our theme song. You can find out more about Marco and his music on our website at soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.